America has spent an unprecedented amount of money attempting to fix the economy and hold current social programs together. This is accomplished through borrowing, whereby Uncle Sam sells Treasury securities of varying maturity, a process that goes back decades. Yet that borrowing adds to the national debt, which is now roughly equivalent to the entire goods and services producing sector in the United States, essentially everything we make, valued at around $16.5 trillion. Economists tell us that any debt over 90% of GDP destroys long-term economic growth, and we're scheduling more debt and larger deficits into the near future. Most informed people agree the national debt is a serious problem, but agreement varies considerably on how it should be addressed. We'll talk about what's really at stake and explore the alternatives just ahead on Media Meet. Welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are 32nd District State Senator Roger Kahn of Saginaw Township, the Sam M. Cahotas Professor of Economics at Northern Michigan University, Tawny Ferrarini, and Professor Emeritus in Political Science at NMU, Robert Kulishek. Welcome. The United States has a history of deficit spending, and there are some, by some accounts, good reason for it when goals are relatively short term. We're now at $16.5 trillion and growing by the minute. What's wrong with that in the most practical terms?
Well, our current level of debt, it robs us of a future for our children, robs us of the ability to be able to manage other investments. It creates uncertainty in the job market. And unless we do something about this and do it in fairly short order, all these problems will become worse. And as they worsen, our opportunities going forward will diminish. We will have a potential Greece-like economic future.
To add to that, Tom? Yeah, well, let's just get down to the basics. Okay. What is a government deficit? It occurs in one fiscal year, and when the government spends more than it earns or brings in terms of revenue, we have a deficit. Right. That deficit's paid off by issuing Treasury bonds, notes, and bills that are interest earning. Mm-hmm. And so that interest and those principles add to the debt. A debt is an accumulation of deficits and surpluses of the past. And the last time we had a surplus was in the 1998-2001 period.
I see. Looking at who owns our debt, the federal government has the largest share, about over $6 trillion. I'm sure what the number is right now. My figure's about a year old. It was only $2.5 trillion a decade ago, though. China and Japan each hold over $1 trillion. The UK holds a half trillion. The rest is scattered among other investors, pension funds, mutual funds, state and local governments, and banks. Now, much has been made of this idea of foreign debt. Should we worry about China calling in the note is a question that comes up. Japan's sovereign debt is about 250% of its GDP. Any concerns we should prepare for because of foreign debt, large foreign debt?
Well, from my point of view, and from the point of view of the folks from Fix the Debt, having our debt held by other countries is a potential influencer of policy, and as government goes forward and does its day-to-day decision making. I would just as soon have less debt held by foreign nations, and in particular nations that we have bumpy relationships with.
Okay. Bob, is there much history of problems related to foreign debt and policy?
Well, it all depends on the time period you're working in. There was a period of time in the 1800s where we had extremely high foreign debt in the United States, but this was money coming in primarily from Europe, and it was being used to build our industry and our railroads and that sort of thing. It's somewhat different when your debt is being used to fund future entitlement programs. This becomes much more difficult, and it doesn't generate as much growth in the long run. So I'm very encouraged that the senator is up here talking about fix the debt. And I think that if this is going to happen, it's necessary that we approach that in a bipartisan and non-confrontational way. And that requires that people have to realize we have a short-term problem and we have a long-term problem. The problem has to be solved in part by tax increases, the dangerous word, but it also program cuts and reductions in spending. And another thing I think that's important to do as we approach this is to realize that people who disagree with our positions, whatever that might be, are not necessarily knaves or fools. The people in the Congress and the people in the state legislatures, I think, are working in what they perceive to be the best interest of the country. And you have to be able to strike a balance whereby you can project into the future and have a more balanced budget than the trend lines we're working towards now. So I hope we can avoid some of the partisan confrontations and really deal with some of the difficult and complex issues that aren't just common sense. It really requires some expertise on people in government, business, to try and deal with this. So I'm encouraged by this group coming together, and I hope they'll be able to approach it in that manner.
Okay. The G20 group just agreed to hold the line on currency manipulation. One of the problems was that the cheaper your currency is, the more of an advantage you have in terms of exports. And Japan, for example, has been printing money and devaluing its currency like crazy in order to, you know, in order to make up for this huge debt to GDP ratio it's got right now. That was apparently the motive for the G20 group addressing that particular issue. But they couldn't agree on any measures related to their debt. That is, we look at the big industrialized countries today, and a lot of them have debt problems, and some very severe. What does this mean for American interests in our efforts to control U.S. debt?
Well, you know, the United States was accused of currency manipulation through its quantitative easing and the Fed. So you have China being accused of this, Japan being accused of this. And ironically, some people would say that countries such as Greece and Spain, who are now part of the European monetary system, no longer can control the price of their currencies and are therefore less able to deal with the problems that are confronting them now. So one of those major issues cutting many different ways.
Let's talk about what the Fed's been doing. You know, they've been buying up, they've been buying up securities like crazy. They've been holding interest rates at near zero. This has really punished a lot of savers. And people who traditionally would, if they had money, they had it by stashing it away. Could you address the Fed policy and tell me what you think of it?
Well, the quantitative easing that we're talking about is just discouraging people from saving. But you've got to remember, we have a quick look to our right and a quick look to our left, and we can find alternatives.
Okay.
And the alternative is that, you know, we're not putting our money into the banks. So it's important to step back and kind of look at what's happening. Where are people putting their money in order to grow their savings, in order to prepare for the future? And corporate America is sitting on a ton of money right now. They're just not letting go of it. One of the reasons is they're worried and concerned about some of the things that are happening in the U.S. in terms of its political decisions and where it stands now and where it's heading in the future, because all we have to do is look around the globe, look at Greece. Over one out of every four people are unemployed. They've abandoned universal health care. They have done away with a lot of their entitlement programs, not out of want, which is where we are right now. It's out of need. They have to. Mm-hmm. What's really nice about today is that we can look to our neighbors to our north, Canada. Mm-hmm. They were in a similar position to us, and they slowly but surely cut programs across the board. Unlike my friend over here who says we need to raise taxes, they lower taxes because we have to pay attention to what our neighbors around the globe are doing, mm-hmm. and U.S. taxes are relatively high. With lower taxes, you get more spending, you get more investing. But this is an example of where we agree politely to disagree, and that's the great thing, is it's going to take a lot of people sitting around a table to figure out not what you need to do in order to solve this problem, but what can I do to solve that problem. People will recommend cuts elsewhere, but they never recommend cuts in their own programs, but that's the incentive.
Okay. It's a time of unprecedented spending and debt. At a time of unprecedented spending and debt, we continue to raise the debt ceiling. Why should we not expect this sort of ever-bloating total does not merely contribute to the problem?
Well, the debt ceiling is really, I think, a symptom of other problems, a symptom of our failure to make a decision to, in fact, deal with the debt itself. Mm-hmm. You can use control of the ceiling, which will come up within the month, as a way to discipline yourself against, well, the spending excesses we see on the entitlement programs, and that likely will be part of the discussion. I expect it to be a prominent part of the discussion.
Well, last time we had 100% of GDP in our debt, the debt ceiling was raised. This time it's being raised again. We're in the same position. Is this something we should be looking forward to in perpetuity?
Well, I expect you're going to see the argument shift to something that's not so much per se about the debt ceiling, mm-hmm. but rather the trajectory of the debt. Is it going up? Is it going down? Are we getting better control over what our debt is? And you're going to see it argued within the framework of the goods and services that our people create, the gross national product, and the percent of debt that is represented here. As long as it's a controlled number, a number substantially going down, the goal that the folks from the Fix the Debt are talking about is getting it closer to 60%, certainly no more than the current 73%. If we have that done, then the overall level of the debt itself, while disturbing, it won't be uncontrollable.
Okay. By the way, that 73% comes from transfers and accounting moves within the government. Go ahead.
The issue of the debt ceiling, I think, is something that we need to talk about a bit. That the debate over the debt ceiling isn't whether we should set up new programs, but basically it's whether we should honor the programs we've created and pay the debts we've incurred. In the past, both Democrats and Republicans have used it as a device, a rhetorical device, to make the other side uncomfortable. President Obama voted against increasing the debt ceiling at once, but now it's being presented as an either-or thing. It's either you increase this or we default on our loans, which is a very different issue. So I think that, in a sense, the debt ceiling issue sometimes diverts our attention away from the need to look at our underlying problems with regard to handling the deficit in the short term and the debt in the long term. And it's,
I think,
needs
the point,
to be noted.
The point really was that it doesn't seem to discourage more spending.
No, it's something that, you know, if there is no private sector counterpart to this debt ceiling, I mean, all of us could go to our creditor and say, you know what, I've borrowed too much. Go ahead, extend my credit limit, and we would be laughed out of the office. And I understand what Dr. Kulishek is saying here. We do need to look at the long-run problem. We will continue to make our obligations. Remember the fiscal cliff? There was no fiscal cliff during the presidential debates. Why? Because that was something that was generated after to kind of position people so that the president and Congress, and this is a nonpartisan issue, they're both to blame for what the situation, or responsible, it's not to blame, they're responsible. We're all responsible for what the situation is. But the thing is, we have to filter through people in the audience through what is real and what is hype. And the best way we can do that is become a part of movement like this Fix the Debt. It's an easy movement to become involved in, and it starts at home. It starts with you kind of leaning on your representatives and encouraging them to kind of take steps in order to address the issue. And I do believe there's a short-run issue and a long-run issue. We have to address the short-run at the same time as the long-run. Fix that deficit.
Okay.
Let's spend what we bring in. And then that's it. And then we start making these more manageable stats and bring down the percentage of GDP that's captured by the debt.
Okay. Let's talk about how we got here. The one observer, he's the Washington Bureau Chief of the Times, said there are two deficit explanations. One says it's not our fault. that the deficits stem from weak-willed politicians, wasteful government programs that don't benefit us, and tax avoidance by unscrupulous people. This is the explanation we apparently like, as you know, from the polls. The one we'd rather not face, he says, is based on the fact that most Americans are scheduled to receive far more Social Security and Medicare benefits than they've paid in taxes, that they've sanctioned huge military spending and depend on a tax system that's collected less revenue as a share of GDP than at any point in the past 60 years. Now, how would you rate that description? Are these the root problems? There are some who wouldn't blink at saying all of the above.
There was a cartoon character named Pogo once, and the little cartoon always said, we've met the enemy and it's us.
Yes.
Part of the problem that elected representatives have is that when they go back to their constituents are all in favor of a balanced budget until it comes to cutting their particular programs.
Yeah.
And I would add something else. There's a kind of a structural part of this, an institutional part of it. Because of legislative gerrymandering, we now have congressional districts such that there really aren't that competitive races in many of them. And for example, if you look at the Republican Party, the Republicans today, who may be thinking maybe we should have some revenue increases, are very frightened not of their Democratic opponents, but of the primary challenge they're going to get from the people further to the right. So you wind up with maybe a cluster of people in the middle that's the majority would be willing to work out a compromise, but the people being elected are afraid that their constituents who are primarily in safe districts might be more responsive to the more extreme. And that's true both the right and the left.
Yeah, and that's rightfully so. Remember, they want to keep their job. That's how they feed their families. That's how they save and invest in their communities. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the average person sitting on and walking down the street that's responsible for this. It's those active voters, because that's who the politicians listen to. And it's the organized people. And so it's all of our problem. And as Milton Friedman said, there is nothing that is so dangerous and does as much harm as good intentions. Because it is true that our politicians can start off with good intentions. Social Security is a good example. For a long time, we had surpluses, and it was a comfortable saying. You know, you can lean on Social Security during your retirement years. Mm-hmm. But the word was lean. It was not depend. And because of the changes in demographics, we have a real issue in Social Security right now. And that is going to be a problem that we're going to have to address.
Okay. The issue is that
Just a moment here, if I could, to remind our viewers and especially our radio listeners that we're talking about the national debt with 32nd District State Senator Roger Kahn of Saginaw Township, the Sam M. Cahotas Professor of Economics at Northern Michigan University, Tawny Ferrarini, and NMU Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Robert Kulishek. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think these are both excellent points. But what I run across is the issue of mandated services that build on themselves. Mm-hmm. You end up getting into the argument is, do you believe in Social Security or don't, rather than the reforms that would be needed to fix Social Security, like changing eligibility ages or mean testing it. Those are the sort of things that need to be part of the discussion and sadly, often are not part of the discussion.
Observers
the same thing happens
security
with...
Security is one of the most fixable things about the debt, and it's being ignored.
That's exactly the point I would make. And you find the same thing with Medicare or Medicaid, or disability insurance, or federal pensions. All of these, the idea, borrow your Friedman quote, were good intentions, but they've grown in a way sort of like Topsy, mm-hmm. where they've are no longer appropriately centered.
Okay. I would like to add something with regard to Social Security. Yeah. If you take Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, someone would said, Social Security is like algebra. Medicaid and Medicare is like calculus. It's much more difficult. Social Security is basically fixable. I used to teach a course in public policy, and there's like 10 different things you could make some minor adjustments, and you would have Social Security solvent for the indefinite future. And it's really quite solvent right now. I don't think Social Security right now is part of the deficit problem. It's actually more money coming in. You're looking down into the future on that particular one. So I don't see that as a big problem, or that we've even overpromised on Social Security. That's savable with some minor changes if you could come to some bipartisan consensus. Okay. Where we have difficulty, and we could get into a long discussion of Medicare and Medicaid and the new Health Care Act, but that's where we have to figure out how to control costs. And there's some real legitimate policy debate as to how best to do that. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal last week showing that if you look at the part of the deficit that's out of control, it's basically in entitlement spending and defense. It is not in the non-approvable each year parts of the budget. The irony is that that is the part of the budget that's going to be cut under the sequestering, the part of the budget that isn't growing and is actually shrinking.
Right. There are no Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security cuts in the sequester.
No.
Go ahead.
And so the point is that that's the sword over our head to try and get us to act right now, but the parts of government that would be cut aren't the parts that are causing the problem. And we have to deal with the long-term entitlement problems, and that deals primarily with the medical side of it, even more so than Social Security, which could be fixed relatively easily. And I could offer some suggestions, which I won't do, but with regard to the medical side, that's much more difficult.
And I'd like to bring us right back to where we started, is that there are manageable solutions that could help us achieve the goal that was brought to us earlier. And it's just like, let's take steps in order to say we're going to reduce the amount of national debt as a share of GDP. Mm-hmm. And Social Security would be an easy start.
That's exactly the goal of this organization.
When we run into problems in enunciating the goal and moving towards it, because the Congressional Budget Office seems to have sort of a moving set of statistics that they use about what the debt is and how we calculate it. Have you noticed that?
Well, but that's okay. We know when the percentage of GDP, because on both sides of it, it's okay. We know if we're going to be shrinking the debt. We can get a general feel for it. We don't have to be precise. We don't have to be clearly accurate, but we know which direction we're going in because we can tell by movements in terms of people who are wanting to hold our debt, who's holding our debt, how long are they holding our debt, are they still trading with us, are we getting pressure from outside nations to change what we're doing. So there are a lot of signals that can be sent that have nothing to do with the exact figures, but we'll get a sense for it. And I think that fix the debt effort is a really good, strong effort, and I encourage all the listeners and the people who are watching today to get involved.
I think what's interesting about Fix the Debt is that it's virtually everything is on the table.
Yes, it is.
And it's bipartisan.
But it's a necessity to make it work. If it's going to be a Republican solution or a Democrat solution, you can count on the other side not being cooperative. We have to look at this together.
Okay. Let's just for a moment here, let's just talk about tax reform, which, like Social Security reform, has sort of been left hanging when it comes to anything like concrete legislation. Some say it's clear it will mean a broader base of taxpayers, I mean more people paying, and most Americans are just seeing a significant increase for the first time in years. Should it be on a near-term agenda, or is it politically too dangerous, tax reform?
Well, we did some tax reform, a little bit of anyway, in January 1 as part of getting where we are now. That's going to need to continue. And I do think if you want to raise money, you got two ways you can do it. You can increase the rate or you can increase the number of folks that are paying it. Mm-hmm. We need to broaden the base as part of whatever discussion we have to get to a place where the debt to GDP ratio begins to fall. That has to be part of it, along with the discussion on entitlements. And insofar as we look at only one of these or the other of it, we lose the ability to enlist help from the other side of the political spectrum. You have to do it together.
I'm the free market economist sitting in this group, so I'd like to bring us back in history and look at the Kennedy and Bush tax because there is a third way in order to increase revenue, and that is by decreasing taxes so that you increase the volume of consumption, savings, and investment.
You should mention, just for people who are unfamiliar, that in the early days of the income tax, it might be up to 90% for some people, and then, you know, somewhere down the road, considerably down the road, John F. Kennedy proposed lowering taxes and increasing defense spending, and he rescued the economy.
Just like the Republican counterpart Bush at the same time. And the thought there is, and let's just go through the thought experiment, is that you're putting the dollar in the hands of the individuals who are living in households, and they're the ones who are operating businesses, and they get to choose how to stimulate the economy, how to grow the economy, so that you can increase that tax base by increasing the volume of trade. Mm-hmm. And so that, with that said, I'm going to
Let me respond to that, that I think a prescription, we have a physician here, so you can use a metaphor of prescriptions. A prescription has to be designed to deal with the disease you're handling at the particular time. And if you look back at the Kennedy years, a tax cut would be appropriate at that time. Other times, tax cuts may not be as appropriate. Many of the things that were listed under supply-side economics tax cuts did not necessarily produce the increase in revenue that were anticipated and actually led to more deficits. Also, using a medical analogy, the size of the dosage has to be taken into consideration. And tax cuts, if they are too large, can be counterproductive. So you have to fine-tune. Tax cuts are sometimes appropriate, sometimes not appropriate. You have to figure out what the times are, and you have to figure out the amount to do it. Simply saying tax cuts are always the answer to every problem, and the more the better, isn't necessarily the answer.
Okay. We're talking, you know, overall, it seems to me, we're talking about a couple of things. Tawney has recently updated a book she co-authored called Common Sense Economics, and she notes two competing visions for the future that we seem to be discussing, really, when we're discussing the debt and the budget and other related topics. It's limited versus big government, economic freedom versus dependency, and personal responsibility versus collectivism. Not necessarily as exclusive, okay? You imply we can improve upon our choices by becoming more economically literate, Tawney. Where do we start?
We start, I think, in the home. You know, we start teaching our young ones as early as preschool that they don't always have to spend. It's save and it's invest and live within a budget, live within your means. There are numerous examples out there where people who have launched themselves out of entitlement programs, out of welfare, and become very successful entrepreneurs, not only to help themselves, their families, but to bring others into prosperity with them. And so I'm a big advocate for education and putting the power back into the homes and into the businesses.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. We've been talking about the national debt with 32nd District State Senator Roger Kahn of Saginaw Township, Sam M. Cahotas, Professor of Economics at Northern Michigan University, Tawney Ferrarini, and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at NMU, Robert Kulishek. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Gee, I love that idea.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
Some increase in funding for...
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.